Hello, this is Jane from the Talking Information Center. Today we will be reading from the Wednesday, July 1st, 2026 edition of Reuters News. Despite some big losses, Supreme Court rewards Trump's power play. By Andrew Chung and John Cruzell. On Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court ended Donald Trump's quest to narrow who can be considered a citizen if born in the United States, a harsh loss for the Republican president. But just one day before, it handed him a form of power that the dissenting justices said even English monarchs of the past did not possess. The top U.S. judicial body issued rulings on Tuesday in three important cases as it brought to a close another momentous nine-month term heavily focused on legal disputes involving Trump and his administration. The court, which has a 6-3 conservative majority, dealt Trump three big losses during the term on tariffs, birthright citizenship, and his bid to fire a member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. But it also continued to back his aggressive use of executive authority, vastly expanding the power of the presidency. The Trump administration has pushed a robust vision of executive power, which the court has largely embraced, George Mason University law professor Robert Luther III said. Serious disruption. In his second term as president, Trump has pushed to expand his powers in domestic affairs and foreign policy, drawing numerous legal challenges. When these cases have reached the Supreme Court, it generally has been highly deferential to Trump, avoiding direct confrontation with the norm-shattering president on all but his most audacious assertions of executive authority. The exceptions to that general trend are cases in which the president's position was so far removed from any conceivable legal justification that the Supreme Court was unwilling to follow quite that far, or in which the Supreme Court seemed to fear serious disruption to the markets or broader economy, Syracuse University College of Law professor Jenny Breen said. The Supreme Court's workload this term has been marked to an unusual degree with cases involving the president, with much of the action occurring on an emergency basis on its so-called shadow docket. In such cases, the justices often make rapid and highly consequential decisions outside their regular process, without extensive briefing and oral arguments held in public, and typically with little explanation of their legal rationale. The conservative majority backed Trump in most of these cases, letting him implement key policies while challenges to their legality played out in lower courts. In such cases during this term, the court let him carry out aggressive immigration raids that can target individuals based on their race or language, cut National Institutes of Health grants for research related to racial minorities or LGBT people, and bar passport applicants from selecting the sex reflecting their gender identities for the document. Beyond emergency cases, the court has also resolved cases in Trump's favor in the traditional manner, after extensive deliberation, briefing, and arguments, including by acceding to Trump's efforts to restrict immigration. The court often has deferred to the president on such matters like immigration and national security. Last week, the court's conservatives gave Trump and his administration three victories over the dissent of the liberal justices, making it easier to deport people or refuse them entry, including those who have legal status in the United States. Among those rulings, the court let the administration strip hundreds of thousands of Haitian and Syrian immigrants of a humanitarian legal status, protecting them from deportation. Humphrey's executor. On Monday, the court's conservatives delivered a watershed ruling that some legal experts said boosts Trump's power under the U.S. Constitution more than any prior ruling in the history of the Supreme Court. They freed Trump to fire leaders at independent government regulators, placing the levers of the government's executive power firmly in his hands. In the process, the court overturned a precedent dating to 1935 in a case called Humphrey's Executor versus the United States that had insulated such officials from at-will firings by a president. Overturning Humphrey's executive for years had been a priority of the U.S. conservative legal movement. Critics of the move said the court's action will lead to further politicization of federal agencies that Congress had sought to entrust to nonpartisan experts, as well as to broader partisan swings in American regulatory policy. The dissenting liberal justices said the ruling handed too much power to the president, allowing him even to act in defiance of laws. The court gives the president a power unknown even to the English crown against which the founders revolted, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, joined by fellow liberal justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Cornell Law School professor Gautam Hans said the decision represents the triumph of decades of conservative advocacy. Whatever losses the administration has had, they're probably quite happy with that prize, Hans said. Embracing Trump's legal positions. Some legal experts also emphasized that the Supreme Court adopted the Trump administration's legal positions in certain major cases in which the president was not an original party to the dispute, but rather assumed an amicus or friend of the court role. These included in a landmark decision in April that gutted a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. That 6-3 ruling, powered by the conservative justices, made it harder for minorities to challenge electoral maps as racially discriminatory under that historic 1965 civil rights law. The ruling opened the door for Republican-led southern states to dismantle Democratic-held majority black and majority Latino districts ahead of the midterms. Black and Latino voters tend to support Democratic candidates. Trump's fellow Republicans seek to retain control of Congress in the November midterm elections. Major losses. Although the justices were largely deferential to Trump, two searing defeats he sustained this term revealed his reluctance to strengthen the president's hand over the economy. In a 6-3 decision in February, authored by conservative Chief Justice John Roberts, the court struck down Trump's sweeping global tariffs that he pursued under a law meant for use in national emergencies. The loss prompted Trump to lash out in remarkably personal terms at the six justices who ruled against him, including two of his own appointees, Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett. "I think it's an embarrassment to their families. You want to know the truth? The two of them," Trump said, referring to the pair. In another painful defeat, the court on Monday refused to let Trump fire Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook, standing firm to preserve central bank independence. Despite these losses, Trump's record at the midway point of his second term is far more favorable than that of his Democratic predecessor, President Joe Biden, who the court dealt a sustained and historic series of defeats. This court had essentially the same composition of justices during President Biden's term, but was more likely to rule against his major exertions of presidential power, Breen said. Of course, every case presents different legal arguments, but the comparison is striking. The court on Tuesday ruled that Trump's executive order seeking to deny birthright citizenship to the children of certain immigrants violated language in the Constitution's 14th Amendment that confers citizenship to those born in the United States who are subject to the jurisdiction thereof. George Mason University's Luther called the birthright citizenship ruling wrongly decided and a catastrophic loss. "Its consequences will be felt throughout the country for decades to come," Luther said of that decision. But the Trump administration has largely been rewarded for pursuing an ambitious vision of executive power, and I encourage them to continue because it's generally been rewarded for doing so. Trump reports over $1.4 billion in income from crypto ventures by Tom Bergen, Coqueed King, and Douglas Gillison. U.S. President Donald Trump reported more than $1.4 billion in income from his family's crypto ventures last year, showing how Trump now derives most of his income from digital assets that have benefited from his policies, according to a review of his latest financial disclosures on Tuesday. The filings, his annual disclosure for 2025 with the U.S. Office of Government Ethics, disclosed that his companies received almost $800 million from World Liberty Financial, a crypto venture he and his sons co-founded. That income, which the president splits with family members, included more than $520 million from sales of crypto tokens and more than $250 million from the sale of interests in the World Liberty business. Trump reported another $635 million from the sale of his Trump meme coins. The news underlines how crypto has transformed the president's fortunes. In his disclosure a year ago, for example, the president reported $57.35 million from token sales at World Liberty, which then leaped ninefold in this year's filing. Reuters recently estimated the Trump family has made at least $2.3 billion from crypto-related projects since Trump returned to the White House in 2025. On taking office, Trump began to put in place policies and initiatives that the industry saw as beneficial, from implementing federal rules for stable coins to dialing back policing of the industry by the U.S. Justice Department and the Securities and Exchange Commission. For 2025, the president also reported over $80 million in income from settlements with various media companies and $52 million in income from his company licensing his name to overseas property developers, driven principally by deals with Middle Eastern partners. White House spokesperson Anna Kelly said in a statement, "Neither the president nor his family has ever engaged or will ever engage in conflicts of interest. President Trump proudly made the United States the crypto capital of the world through executive actions." Kelly added, "All actions by President Trump and his administration are taken in the best interest of the American people. And any so-called reporters pushing otherwise are recycling the same tired, false narrative that Democrats and the legacy media have been pushing for a decade." While the White House has previously said the president's business interests are currently overseen by his children, the president remains the beneficiary of the assets in the trust that ultimately receives the income. New wealth driven by crypto. Although crypto is by far the largest driver of income for Trump, his traditional businesses, in particular golf courses and resorts, continued to bring in millions. Trump reported a 15% rise in revenue at his golf and resort facilities to just over $500 million in 2025. The strongest increases were at clubs where the president has spent considerable time since his 2025 inauguration. Revenue at his Mar-a-Lago club in Florida, which Trump dubbed the Winter White House, soared to $77 million from $50 million in 2024. While revenue at his golf club in nearby West Palm Beach jumped 27%. Revenue fell at Trump's Los Angeles course last year. Trump also secured a more than $50 million loan last year from Charles Schwab Bank, the filing showed. They did not say what the loan was for. Trump hosted winners of his second annual meme coin contest at Mar-a-Lago in April. Trump's income from his real estate interests, the business in which he made his name, had less spectacular growth. He reported income from a dozen significant commercial real estate ventures, mainly interests in buildings he built or acquired decades ago. The filing doesn't give specific rent figure for properties like Trump Tower in New York, but rather income ranges. For most, the income range in 2025 was the same or lower than Trump reported a decade prior. A spokesperson for the Trump family business at the Trump Organization said in a statement that the breadth and depth of this filing further underscores our commitment to transparency. At nearly 1,000 pages, it represents one of the most comprehensive financial disclosure reports ever submitted and demonstrates a level of financial transparency unmatched in presidential history. A spokesperson for World Liberty Financial declined to comment. Don Fox, a former acting head of the Federal Ethics Office, which oversees ethics regulations for federal workers and reviews financial disclosures, including Trump's, said presidents and vice presidents are exempted from the ethics laws that prohibit conflicts of interest among executive branch employees. Every president in the post-Watergate era has managed his finances as though he were subject to conflicts of interest, said Fox. With Trump, those norms are just totally out the window. He makes the case better than anyone that it's time for additional ethics reforms. I think in terms of legislation, one thing that could be done would be to limit the type of investments he and the vice president can hold. FBI determines that Nancy Guthrie kidnapping notes to be fake, source says, by Jana Winter and Steve Gorman. All three kidnapping-related messages that have surfaced in news media reports about the disappearance of Today Show co-host Savannah Guthrie's elderly mother have been deemed by federal investigators to be fake communications, an FBI official told Reuters on Tuesday. The FBI assessment of inauthenticity pertains to the two ransom notes reported in early February, days after 84-year-old Nancy Guthrie vanished, and a third, more recent message from someone claiming to know the kidnappers' identities, the officials said. None of the ransom notes are believed to be genuine, the FBI official told Reuters, speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss details of an active investigation. A second law enforcement source familiar with the matter confirmed the FBI assessment of the ransom notes. The disclosure that the FBI has discounted the veracity of the three notes, two of which were widely reported to have been communications from kidnappers, seemed to raise doubts about investigators' fundamental premise that Nancy Guthrie was abducted for ransom to begin with. A spokesperson for the Pima County Sheriff's Department, which is leading the overall investigation, declined to comment, citing its agreement to refer all inquiries regarding ransom notes to the FBI. We don't have any updates other than this is still an active investigation, the sheriff's spokesperson, Angelica Carrillo, said. She added that DNA samples and video evidence collected in the case remain under forensics analysis. All three messages in question were initially delivered to various media outlets, including celebrity news site TMZ.com, before they were turned over to authorities for review. Savannah Guthrie, 54, longtime co-anchor of the NBC Morning News program Today, has referenced ransom demands in video messages she and her siblings have posted on social media, urging kidnappers to open a direct line of communication with her family and pleading for her mother's return, saying in one video, "We will pay." Cryptocurrency payment went unclaimed. The elder Guthrie, who had been in frail health with limited mobility, was last seen alive at her home in Tucson, Arizona on January 31st, after spending an evening with her older daughter, Annie Guthrie, and her son-in-law. The FBI, which has taken the lead in examining any purported ransom notes or other communications from suspects in the case, had previously declined to say publicly whether any of the messages under review were considered credible. Investigators determined that the first two originated from the same sender, the official told Reuters, though how that conclusion was drawn was not specified. The first note, according to TMZ, demanded a sum in the millions to be paid in cryptocurrency and set two deadlines for payment, on February 5th and February 9th. The second note was reported by NBC News last week to have referred to Guthrie at that point as having died without making an apology or demanding any payment for the return of her body. In a bid to test the authenticity of the first note and possibly trace the ransom demands back to the perpetrators, the FBI early on deposited a small amount of cryptocurrency in an account as instructed in the message, but the money was left untouched in the account and never taken, the official said. It was on that basis and by other unspecified means that the FBI reached the conclusion that the two ransom notes that it determined to be of a common origin were nevertheless sent by a person or persons not actually connected with Guthrie's disappearance, according to the official. The FBI has additionally discounted the authenticity of a third note that TMZ reported it received last week from someone claiming to know the identities of Nancy Guthrie's abductors and to have video of the main guy involved in her kidnapping, as well as of the victim on the day she died. The FBI official did not reveal how investigators ruled out the third note as fake. Reacting to last week's ransom note headlines from NBC News, the home network of today, Savannah Guthrie took time on her show to appeal to the public again for answers to the fate of her mother, urging anyone who might know something to come forward. Guthrie also reminded viewers of the $1 million reward being offered by her family, whom she described as being in agony since her mother vanished. Authorities confirmed soon after her disappearance that DNA tests showed that blood found on Nancy Guthrie's front porch came from her. Media attention on the case has waned considerably since mid-February, when the sheriff and FBI released surveillance footage of an armed prowler in a ski mask shown tampering with Nancy Guthrie's doorbell camera shortly before she was abducted. But DNA samples obtained from a glove found near her home and resembling the pair the prowler was seen wearing failed to produce a match against known genetic profiles in a national database. Savannah Guthrie later said her family was still blowing on the embers of hope that her mother was alive, while also acknowledging that she may already be gone. Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce's wedding fascinates and flummoxes the media. By Don Chmielewski. From Los Angeles, the romance between Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce played out in public, but the pop icon and NFL star have so far succeeded in keeping plans for the wedding itself under wraps, leaving fans, internet sleuths, and the news media scrambling for clues as to what to expect. The couple have made no public statements about their plans, and Reuters has not been able to confirm the timing or location of the wedding, which is expected as soon as this week. "We're getting little bits of information that, again, could be decoys, for all we know," said Alana Fishman, style and shopping director for the New York Post's Page Six. "But it really is. I mean, it is Pentagon-level impressive, the security and secrecy around this event." Even before Swift and Kelce announced their engagement on Instagram under the caption, "Your English teacher and your gym teacher are getting married," fans had been ruminating about the most appropriate venue for the pop culture equivalent of a royal wedding. Celebrity site TMZ reported that the invitations arrived, watermarked to prevent leaks, with the time and location kept deliberately vague. The New York Post's Page Six reported that a wedding planner known for organizing lavish affairs won the gig, at least in part because of his discretion. Spokespeople for the couple did not respond to requests for comment. TMZ didn't respond to a request for comment. Internet sleuths on the case. The couple's vacation to Lake Como, Italy, in May 2024, sparked speculation the couple was inspecting potential wedding venues such as the Villa d'Este. The wedding platform Wedding Chicks shared an Instagram post suggesting the wedding would be held at Swift's oceanfront mansion in Rhode Island, where she has hosted star-studded July 4th parties. Five New York Times reporters shared a byline on a story reporting that Madison Square Garden would host a multi-day event, beginning with an intimate gathering on July 2nd, followed by a splashier affair the next day with some 1,000 guests. The Times declined to discuss its coverage plans for the celebration. Internet sleuths have scoured schedules for potential guests. They found actress Mariska Hargitay, recently spotted with Swift at a New York Knicks game, has canceled this Friday's performances of her Broadway play, Every Brilliant Thing, and country singer Kenny Chesney called off his Friday and Saturday concerts in Las Vegas. Billboard's co-editor-in-chief Jason Lipschitz remains skeptical, saying it all could be an elaborate ruse. "She likes upending expectations, and this certainly plays into this," said Lipschitz. Who sings for the singer? Variety's executive music director Gemma Swad said the trade publication typically devoted to the business of Hollywood plans to cover the wedding, adding, "We don't usually do things like that." Reader interest in all things Swift-related warrants extraordinary coverage, he said. "I can say from firsthand experience, nothing gets clicks like Taylor," said Aswad. "Absolutely nothing." Rolling Stone has prepared a number of articles in anticipation of the big day, including a history of the biggest celebrity weddings and a list of Swift's greatest love songs, said Shirley Halpern, co-editor-in-chief. Halpern also speculated that the custom blue T-shirt Swift wore during Game 4 of the NBA Finals, emblazoned with Stevie Nicks, K-N-I-C-K-S, in orange letters, may hint at some role for the former Fleetwood Mac band member Stevie Nicks during the ceremony. "It'll be interesting to see who has a role of being the entertainment at the entertainer's wedding, and who will officiate," said Halpern. "Is it going to be a major musician?" Older Americans left out of costly GLP-1 craze expected to flock to new program by Chris Prentice and Amina Niyasi. From New York, millions more Americans will qualify for obesity medications at just $50 a month under a new Medicare program starting on Wednesday, bringing the highly effective drugs to people age 65 and older at an affordable price. The U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services 18-month trial program will offer for the first time Novo Nordisk's Wegovy and Eli Lilly's Foundayo and Zepbound as a weight loss treatment alone. Medicare, which also covers people with disabilities, has been barred from weight loss coverage and had paid for the drugs only when prescribed for co-conditions like cardiovascular issues and severe fatty liver disease. Now the program offers three pathways for some Medicare subscribers to qualify for coverage. Eligible patients are estimated in the single-digit millions, a U.S. official said recently. Wall Street analysts estimate that will amount to billions of dollars in revenue for the drug makers. The new price offers a remarkable shift from the past few years, when patients have faced steep out-of-pocket costs for these drugs, with or without insurance. Some doctors and pharmacists who spoke to Reuters warned that the Medicare approval process for the medicines will be slow and complicated. Some doctors also said they were concerned the coverage won't be extended after 2027, while eight emphasized that regular follow-up care, a nutrition plan, and exercise are particularly important for older people. "This is a big win. For decades, medicine has failed to recognize obesity as a disease," said Dr. Christina Wen of Weight Loss Clinic Knownwell in Atlanta. "Even with program restrictions, we'll be able to offer medications to many patients for the first time." Patients more than ready. Katie Smith, 71, a retired teacher in Manassas, Virginia, said her doctor prescribed a GLP-1, but the cost at her pharmacy was prohibitive. The quote is $1,298.99. "Medicare won't cover it because I'm not diabetic or have sleep apnea," she said, "of conditions that are covered." Smith said she has limited mobility after a spinal cord injury from a car accident in her 20s. She uses a walker, has weakness on one side, and permanent nerve damage. "It's not good to be carrying this extra weight around. They say it's diet and exercise. I've tried it all," she said. "It could be that I won't tolerate a GLP-1, but I would so like to try it." Sandy Henderson, 77, of Oxnard, California, previously had lap band surgery but had to have the band removed following issues. She now takes a compounded GLP-1 because she cannot afford branded drugs, which sell for $149 to $399 a month for cash through the companies or more at retail pharmacies. "I'm thrilled. The ability to have this drug accessible to people who haven't been able to afford it, just wow, it brings tears to my eyes," Henderson said in a phone interview. "Then add to that we're going to save $1,000 plus that we can invest in other forms of our health." Pent-up demand. Executives from Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk have pointed to estimates of as many as 20 million people qualifying for the program, though health research organization KFF this week said nearly 4 million would be eligible based on 2023 data. A CMS spokesperson declined to provide specific enrollment expectations, but Medicare Director Chris Klomp has estimated eligibility to be in the single-digit millions. There's no shortage of pent-up demand. Yale Medicine obesity specialist Dr. Jorge Moreno said he has had some patients reschedule appointments to July after the pilot program has launched. There's a lot of excitement already from patients, he said. I've been getting messages on an almost daily basis. Nonwell's Wen said her practice has hired additional clinicians and prepared patients to expect signing up could take a couple of weeks or more for pre-authorization. Two pharmacy trade organizations said they expect snags in the program's implementation due to the mid-year launch, with little time for pharmacists to learn about the details and the requirement of prior authorization from prescribing clinicians. They and a third trade group expect pharmacies to keep limited inventories of the expensive GLP-1 drugs that could lead to increased wait times for patients, they said. Follow-up and risks. This is an important access development, but older adults should approach GLP-1 therapy as part of a comprehensive obesity care plan, not as a standalone medication, said Dr. John Batsis, a geriatric specialist at University of North Carolina. For older adults, the main concern is not simply pounds lost, but what type of weight is lost. With the rise of GLP-1 medications, concerns have mounted over the potential loss of muscle mass and if weight is regained, whether it is as fat or muscle. One of the biggest risks is the temporary nature of the program, said Dr. Albert Huang, a primary care physician and director of University of Chicago Center for Chronic Disease Research and Policy. If the pilot works well, it could become a bridge to enhanced coverage by insurers who have expressed reservations about the program. To me, the big scientific uncertainty is how long does one need to stay on the drugs to reap the benefits of the weight loss, Huang said. If you're someone signing up for this program, which is only in place temporarily, what happens after 2027? U.S. manufacturing activity eases in June. Prices paid by factories remain elevated. U.S. manufacturing activity slowed in June after surging in the prior month, likely as some of the lift from businesses front-loading orders to avoid shortages and higher prices caused by the Middle East conflict faded. The Institute for Supply Management said on Wednesday its manufacturing PMI slipped to 53.3 last month from 54 in May, which was the highest reading since May of 2022. A reading above 50 indicates expansion in manufacturing, which accounts for 9.4% of the economy. Economists' poll by Reuters had forecast the PMI to be unchanged at 54. Despite June's pullback in activity, manufacturing has grown for six consecutive months, also supported by an artificial intelligence investment boom, which has helped to blunt the hit on factories from the U.S.-Israel war with Iran. The ISM survey's new orders measure fell to a still lofty 56 last month from 56.8 in May. Order backlogs also decreased after rising in the prior month, while exports contracted. Factory inventories, however, rebounded after a prolonged period of contraction. Supply chains improved somewhat, likely because of a fragile ceasefire in the conflict. The survey's supplier deliveries index eased to 57.4 from 60.6 in May, with a reading above 50 indicating slower deliveries. The slight improvement slowed the pace of increase in inflation at the factory gate. The survey's prices paid for inputs measures dropped to a still elevated 73 from 82.1 in May. The shaky truce has pulled oil prices back to pre-war levels, but prices are likely to remain high as the AI spending spree raises the cost of technology goods like semiconductors and electronics. Financial markets expect the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates this year because of inflation. The U.S. central bank this month left its benchmark overnight interest rate in the 3.5% to 3.75% range, but updated quarterly projections showed policymakers expected to raise borrowing costs this year. Factory employment remained depressed in May. Since January 2023, the ISM's Manufacturing Employment Index has contracted in 40 of the 41 months. Four Takeaways from Tuesday's Primaries by Richard Cowan. Anti-establishment progressives racked up another good night in Democratic primary contests on Tuesday, toppling seasoned office holders in Colorado as the party continues its internal battle over how far left it can go without ruining its prospects for taking control of the U.S. Congress. Here are four takeaways. Progressives put together more wins. The shocker of the night was the defeat of 29-year incumbent member of the House of Representatives Progressive Caucus, Diana DeGette, by a 29-year-old labor organizer and lawyer, Milat Kyros. Kyros, who was endorsed by U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, won despite being outgunned more than 2-1 in terms of funding and having called for a full arms embargo on Israel for even defensive weapons. DeGette has said she supports sending only defensive weapons. Since the Gaza War, Israel's longstanding support among Democrats has been eroding. Progressive to flip a district? On the heels of big primary victories in New York City this month, a progressive is now in position to vie for a Republican-held U.S. House of Representatives seat in the general election on November 3rd. This is a race that could help determine whether Democrats win control of the 435-seat chamber that is narrowly held by Republicans. State Representative Manny Rutenel defeated moderate former State Representative Shannon Byrd. He will face Republican U.S. Representative Gabe Evans in what is expected to be a competitive contest. Youth prevails, sometimes. DeGette, 68, lost to the 29-year-old Kyros. The 31-year-old Rutenel defeated 67-year-old Byrd. Age did not stop U.S. Senator John Hickenlooper, 74, however. He handily outran State Senator Julie Gonzalez in the Democratic primary. Over the past decade, Democrats have been clamoring for young blood to replace establishment leaders. The transformation is most apparent in the U.S. House, where Representative Hakeem Jeffries, 55, replaced longtime party leader and octogenarian Nancy Pelosi following the 2022 election. Insurgents rising. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser not only defeated U.S. Senator Michael Bennett, he was winning 55-45% with 81% of the votes counted. Bennett has been in the Senate for more than 17 years, where he gained a reputation as a pragmatist. He previously served as the superintendent of Denver's public schools. The somewhat less establishment Weiser was able to far outpace Bennett in the money race, outspending him by $1 million. Weiser's success comes after Graham Plattner won the Democratic primary in Maine, where he defeated Governor Janet Mills and will now face Republican U.S. Senator Susan Collins in November. Republican senators in Texas and Louisiana also lost their primary races. Wall Street dips as U.S.-Iran tensions weigh on sentiment by Niket Nishant and Avinash P. Wall Street's main indices fell on Wednesday as unease surrounding U.S.-Iran tensions cast a shadow on Middle East peace talks, setting a cautious tone for the second half of the year. Tehran said it would not meet with top U.S. envoys who flew to the region following an outbreak of hostilities, although a source with direct knowledge of the talks as well as an Iranian official said the U.S. and Iran held technical talks in Doha. Contrasting rhetoric suggested a breakthrough may prove to be elusive. Reported false dawns have made the conflict difficult to track, leading some investors to focus instead on the economy's underlying pillars. The declines, however, indicated that the Middle East war was difficult to ignore, especially given the impact the region has on global energy markets. At 10:01 a.m. Eastern Time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 65.31 points to 52,262 spot 87. The S&P 500 shed 19.85 points to 7,479 spot 82, and the NASDAQ Composite lost 141.90 points to 26,073 spot 29. In the second quarter of 2026, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ Composite registered their best quarterly performances since 2020, while the Dow marked its best showing since 2022. I don't get the sense that there's a great deal of euphoria out there at the moment. The mood is sanguine but not complacent, said Benjamin Jones, global head of research at Invesco. Investors are worried the U.S. Federal Reserve might need to hike interest rates and keep them elevated to control inflation. Traders expect the central bank to raise borrowing costs at least once by the end of the year, according to data compiled by LSEG. The heavyweight information technology index fell 1.4%, leading losses on the benchmark index. Meta platform shares jumped 8.4%. after a report said the Facebook parent is building a cloud business to sell excess AI computing capacity. The broader S&P 500 Communication Services Index was up 2.3%. Interest rate uncertainty is also high because Kevin Warsh, who took over as Federal Reserve Chair in May, has launched a review that could reshape the way the central bank communicates with the public. In his first policy meeting as chair, he built consensus around a policy statement that jettisoned any forward guidance on the central bank's near-term actions. Warsh reiterated this message when he spoke at a forum in Portugal, joined by other central bank heads. Separately, U.S. manufacturing activity slowed in June after surging the prior month, data from the Institute for Supply Management showed. Markets will now look for clues on the health of the labor market on Thursday when the non-farm payrolls report for June is due to be released. Other movers include Shutterstock, which plunged nearly 31% after calling off its planned merger with Getty Images. Kroger fell 1% after the grocer announced it would buy regional supermarket chain Giant Eagle in a $1.65 billion deal. Advancing Issues outnumbered decliners by a 1.2-to-1 ratio on the New York Stock Exchange and by a 1.35-to-1 ratio on the NASDAQ. Neither the S&P 500 nor the NASDAQ Composite posted any 52-week highs or lows. Fed's Warsh will decide on rate hike when policymakers shut the door at the next meeting. By Howard Schneider. U.S. central bankers will decide whether to raise interest rates when they shut the door and begin their next meeting, U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Kevin Warsh said on Wednesday at an international panel where he told questioners they would fail to break his rule against forward guidance. We get into that room and shut the door. We're going to have a good debate, but I don't have much more for you than that, the U.S. central bank's new chief said at a panel appearance alongside other top monetary policymakers at the European Central Bank's annual policy forum in Sintra, Portugal. I am not going to give forward guidance, Warsh continued, answering a follow-up question from CNBC anchor Sarah Eisen, saying that Sarah is trying to get me to break this rule. She is going to fail. It is Warsh's first appearance outside the Fed's policy meeting last month as he discussed his approach to the job on a stage with European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde, Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey, and Bank of Canada Governor Tiff McClem. These policymakers are all dealing with elevated inflation and the fallout from the U.S.-backed war in Iran, but it has taken them all in different directions. Warsh's comments after the June 16th through 17th policy meeting prompted investors to boost odds the Fed will raise interest rates as soon as September, while the ECB has already hiked. Central bankers in England and Canada have been more reluctant to tighten monetary policy given local economic weakness. Despite the common goal of 2% inflation, Warsh's peers have taken a broader view on issues like climate change. They also have a stake in the battle over the Fed's independence. The other central bankers were signatories to an unprecedented letter earlier this year in support of former Fed Chair Jerome Powell in his battle with the Trump administration over Fed independence, an issue that hit a key milestone this week when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that federal governor Lisa Cook could keep her job, despite President Donald Trump's announcement last year that he had fired her. Powell has been lauded by his peers as a bulwark in that fight, considered important to maintaining the Fed as a prop to global financial stability. Warsh so far has been reluctant to speak directly to issues like the attempted firing of Cook or the legal pressure brought against Powell. Trump picked Warsh to succeed Powell, who remains a member of the Fed's Board of Governors. The new chair took office in late May. Meta loses bid to dismiss U.S. states' claims that Facebook and Instagram addict children, by Jonathan Stemple. A federal judge rejected Meta Platform's bid to dismiss a lawsuit by 29 U.S. state attorneys general, accusing it of designing Facebook and Instagram to addict children and knowingly concealing the harm from the public. In a decision late Monday, U.S. District Judge Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers in Oakland, California, denied Meta's motion to dismiss claims based on deception, unfair practices, and violations of the Federal Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. The judge also said Meta did not comply with that law's notice and parental consent requirements and granted summary judgment to the states on that issue. Meta said in a statement, "We strongly disagree with these allegations and are confident the evidence will show our longstanding commitment to supporting young people." In a separate statement, California Attorney General Rob Bonta called the decision a critical win in holding Meta accountable for fueling a mental health crisis among American children. Gonzalez-Rogers also oversees related multi-district litigation by more than 2,600 individuals, school districts, and local governments over whether social media platforms such as Facebook, Instagram, Google, and YouTube, Snapchat, and TikTok addict children. Meta downplays harms. The states said research has shown that children's use of Facebook and Instagram could lead to depression, anxiety, insomnia, interference with education and daily life, and self-harm, including suicide. Meta countered that the attorneys general had no evidence it misled consumers about its platform's alleged addictiveness, including in congressional testimony by chief executive Mark Zuckerberg. The Menlo Park, California-based company said this was because social media addiction is not an established psychiatric condition, and therefore statements that its platforms are not addictive could not be false. Meta also said it didn't violate the Children's Online Privacy Law because it directed Facebook and Instagram to a general audience, not just children under age 13. Judge finds factual disputes about addictiveness. In a 38-page decision, Gonzalez-Rogers found material factual disputes over whether Meta's social media platforms are addictive, whether Meta falsely denied it designed them that way, and whether it partially directed the platforms at children. The AGs present a reasonable interpretation of Meta's statements that Facebook and Instagram are not designed in ways that cause teens to compulsively use the platforms to their detriment, the judge wrote. To the extent plaintiff's evidence shows that the platforms are in fact designed to do just that, a jury could reasonably find the statements were untrue to a reasonable person, she added. A trial over California, Colorado, Kentucky, and New Jersey's claims against Meta is scheduled for August 18th, court records show. Warnings galore as largest U.S. power grid braces for record demand, by Tim McLaughlin. From Boston, PJM, the largest U.S. electric grid operator, on Wednesday detailed price spikes and warnings of massive transmission line congestion as it braced for record-breaking demand driven by a heat wave ahead of July 4th celebrations. Spot wholesale electricity prices early Wednesday surged to nearly $300 per megawatt hours in some parts of PJM's territory, which serves 67 million people in the Mid-Atlantic, South, and Washington, D.C. During off-peak or milder periods, spot prices typically hover around $25 to $40 per megawatt hours. PJM's low voltage alert signaled that the risk of rotating outages is higher as voltage levels on transmission lines weaken. The grid operator also has forewarned power plants to bring generators out of maintenance so they can be ready to meet surging demand. Grid expert George Root, CEO of Gridhaven, said extreme heat, low wind, and surging demand are coinciding at a time when transmission lines have the least margin for safety. That is contributing to spikes in electricity prices as the cost of moving power rises amid heavy congestion. Temperatures this week are forecast to hover around 100 degrees Fahrenheit from Boston to Washington, D.C., near Northern Virginia's vast data center hub, driving a surge in air conditioning demand that will further strain PJM and other regional power grids. PJM's biggest test will come around 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, when grid demand is expected to be 166.3 gigawatts. That would break an all-time demand record of 165.6 gigawatts set 20 years ago, according to PJM's latest forecast. To meet unexpected shortages, PJM reported 18 gigawatts of reserve power resources that can be brought online within 30 minutes. That's about six times higher than the reliability requirement. Meanwhile, spot electricity prices will likely spike to more than $1,000 per megawatt hour Wednesday evening as PJM operators manage congested power lines around Virginia's data center hub and dispatch expensive power plants, mainly fueled by gas and coal, to meet the day's highest electricity consumption. In the Midwest, another electric demand record could be broken as early as Wednesday evening. That's when forecasts by the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, the regional grid operator for 15 U.S. states in the Midwest and the South, indicate that the demand record of 171.1 gigawatts could fall. U.S. and Iran enter technical talks to secure peace deal, shipping restart. By Andrew Mills, Ahmad Elliman, and Bo Erickson. From Doha, Dubai, and Washington, the U.S. and Iran held indirect technical talks in Doha on Wednesday as they seek to agree on the flow of shipping through the Strait of Hormuz and secure a lasting ceasefire, a source with direct knowledge of the talks and an Iranian official said. The talks are based on a 14-point interim accord signed last month that was meant to halt the war that began with U.S.-Israeli strikes on Iran in February and reopen the strait, while setting up 60 days of negotiations for a permanent peace deal. However, the U.S. and Iran have sparred publicly over the meaning of the interim pact, leading to tit-for-tat military strikes over the past week and leaving little sign of progress on more complex issues, including on Iran's nuclear program. Iran is determined to win international recognition of its control over the strait and its ability to levy fees on ships entering or leaving the Gulf, even if it has to do so by force, according to two senior Iranian officials. Traffic has partially resumed through the waterway, which handled one-fifth of global oil and liquefied natural gas trade before the war. U.S. President Donald Trump, who has said removing Iran's highly enriched uranium is a top priority, told reporters on Wednesday that the denuclearization of Iran is moving along well without giving details. They've had very good meetings and we'll see, he said of the talks in Doha, where there was no evidence the nuclear issue had yet been discussed. focus on Hormuz and frozen assets. The indirect talks mediated by Qatar and Pakistan began on Tuesday night and were continuing on Wednesday, the Iranian officials said. They are structured as sessions between chief negotiators and specialists, the source with knowledge of the talks said, adding that Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner and envoy Steve Witkoff met Qatar's prime minister to lay groundwork for the talks, but would not be attending. Kushner and Witkoff later met Qatar's emir to discuss the U.S.-Iran negotiations and developments in Lebanon, where a parallel conflict between Israel and Iran-backed militant group Hezbollah erupted in early March. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Kazem Gharibabadi headed a delegation of representatives from Iran's foreign ministry, central bank and agriculture ministry, meeting Qatar's prime minister and holding talks with mediators. Iran has stated publicly that its priorities include agreeing on management of the strait and the release of $6 billion in Iranian frozen assets, and the Iranian official said the current round of discussions would focus on those two issues. The stated priority of the U.S. is to ensure the free flow of traffic through the strait, the source with knowledge of the talks said. Iran state media said on Wednesday a foreign container ship had run aground in the Strait of Hormuz after entering shallow waters outside the shipping route designated by Iranian authorities. Hormuz continues to reopen, but it's patchy, unpredictable, and not fully transparent, said Vandana Hari, founder of oil markets analyst provider Vanda Insights. The war triggered Iranian attacks on Gulf states hosting U.S. military bases and killed thousands of people, mainly in Iran and Lebanon, as well as pushing up oil and fuel prices. Trump faces domestic pressure to contain the economic fallout from the war before midterm elections in November, as well as criticism from his own party that the interim deal leaves U.S. objectives unmet. In Iran, the theocratic leadership survived the war but faces domestic anger over a shattered economy. The U.S. has backed a separate track of talks between Israel and Lebanon's government, which produced a framework security deal that Hezbollah has dismissed, and analysts warn could entrench Israel's occupation of Lebanon's south. There had been intensive diplomatic activity on Lebanon between parties, including the U.S., up to Tuesday evening, the source with knowledge of the talks said.